chamber, honor, pride, and distinction. The speaker I extend to you, lovely Muriel, your wife, a hearty welcome on behalf of my colleagues of the House of Representatives. Minority Leader to yield time to several members who have requested to speak. In view of the time frame within which we are operating, members should limit their remarks to approximately 2 minutes. At this time, the Chair recognizes Mr. Wright of Texas, the Majority Leader.
Hubert, old friend, we asked you here. So we can tell you, we love you. You're a friend to most of us, which does not place us in any particularly exclusive society, because throughout your life, you've been a friend of the human race. To us in the lawmaking business, you are a particular inspiration. You're not the youngest one among us, but you are the most energetic and the most enthusiastic and the most irrepressible one among us. You're not exactly the newest member of this Congress, but you do have the freshest ideas and the most indestructible ideals. You are the only one of us I know who has never allowed success to spoil into conceit, nor an occasional failure to produce the faintest taint of bitterness. And we love you for that. I believe that when the annals of our time are written, the name Hubert Humphrey will stand for all that was best in American society for our time. Throughout this remarkable American's career, his clear calls to the national conscience have been a comfort for the afflicted, and occasionally an affliction to the comfortable. As the speaker has said, when many would cover over the scars of racial injustice with cosmetic salve, he was the hair shirt to our complacency. In 1968, when the nation and his own political party were split in a bitter division, he calmed the tumult with the prayer of Francis of Assisi. And in 1977, in the weekly meetings of the president and the congressional leadership at the White House, more often than not, it is Hubert Humphrey who provides the well of inspiration from which we all drink, and his wisdom which leads us on to higher planes of thought. So, Hubert, old friend, take care of yourself. We all have need of you, and there's work for you to do. Speaker, I yield to the distinguished Minority Whip, the gentleman from Illinois, Mr. Michael.
my colleagues, it's a pleasure for me to join in the welcome to you and Mrs. Humphrey to this chamber. Senator, you did not have all the advantages of an education here in the House since you went directly from your home state to the other body. But be that as you may, you've built a successful and in many ways an enviable career, thereby showing what disadvantaged politicians can do when they put their mind to it. And Senator, as a man of few words, you admit those few words to a degree and an extent hitherto unknown even in the other body. But your words have made an impression upon the political and social life of this country for many years. The candor compels me to admit that there have been times, I'd say most of the time in fact, when I've disagreed with the certain positions you may have taken. Perhaps it's the fact that our limit on debate over here does not give me time enough to grasp the complexities and nuances and profundities of the higher economics that you have raised to an art form. But differences we may have had on policy have never stopped me from admiring the courage, the candor, and the optimism, the patriotism, and the sheer exuberance that you possess. If they could find a way to discover what makes Hubert Humphrey so energetic, I'm so sure we could solve this energy crisis within 5 minutes. And maybe just one other personal reference. Senator, in 1968, I co-chaired the Republican Truth Squad with your colleague, Senator Curtis. You Democrats called us something else, as I recall. At any rate, I had a chance to learn a little about you as you campaigned, and needless to say, by the time the campaign was over, there was much more I wanted to say about your speeches, but time had run out. Today, 9 years later, all the questions and the insights and skepticism I brought to bear on the Humphrey policies have long gone. What remains is a vision of a man dedicated to his country and his party, a man who has had but one gap in his education. He never has learned the meaning of the word quit. Senator Muriel, wonderful to have you come in on this.
Speaker, I yield to the gentleman from Minnesota, Mr. Frazier.
Senator, I want you to know that we have not had so many members in the chamber since the official photograph today. I also want to note that two of your very closest friends, John Blatnick and Secretary Bob Berglund, are here, former House members, and we're delighted that they've joined us to honor you and Muriel today. Senator, I know that I speak for all of us when I say that your presence today brings new light and new warmth to our chamber. Those of us from Minnesota have been particularly fortunate because you've touched our lives so directly. My own political career began with your first campaign for the United States Senate in 1948, and it's been my generation and other generations of political Minnesotans who continue to look to you for inspiration. And over the years, the stature of Hubert Humphrey has risen steadily in the eyes of the American people. Hubert, you've known great triumphs and defeats. And rarely has the character of a man been so severely tested by the vicissitudes of American politics as the man we honor today. But throughout it all, he never looked back. His political philosophy springs from a well of faith in people and an optimism about the future which inspires all of us who come under the spell of his extraordinary rhetoric. In our state, he has inspired citizens to view participation in the political life of our nation as a high calling. His leadership within the Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party, the party he helped to found, has been unique, for he has refused to impose decisions upon others based upon the power that flows from public office. And instead, he has offered a kind of intellectual and personal leadership which has ennobled the idea of public service. It's especially fitting that many of his friends have decided to honor him by endowing the Hubert H. Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. All of his life, Hubert Humphrey has been a teacher in political as well as academic life. And he's going to go on teaching us about decency, about compassion and justice in the ordering of the affairs of our nation and of the world. And he'll do this because he himself is a decent, deeply compassionate man who seeks both hope and justice for all. I'm honored to join in this very warm welcome to our good friend Hubert Humphrey and to his loyal and devoted wife, Muriel. We're delighted that you're here.
Now, Mr. Speaker, the gentleman from Minnesota, Mr. Frenzel.
Mr. Speaker, Senator Hubert Humphrey, it's my particular pleasure and pride today being able to represent the minority leader, the distinguished gentleman from Arizona, John Rhodes, who is unavoidably absent today, and his remarks will, of course, appear in the record of these proceedings. But I'd like to say a few things for myself, Hubert. It isn't often, in fact, this is unprecedented in my short history here, that we have welcomed representatives of foreign parliaments like the U.S. Senate to this chamber. And we do so only because of the remarkable nature of your service. And John Rhodes wanted to express for himself, and he wanted me to express, the great admiration, respect, and affection, no, not affection, love, that we hold for you. For those emotions across the political, the partisan, the geographical, the philosophical boundaries, and it may come as a surprise to you to know that Republicans can love anybody, but I want to assure you that we love you. On this particular day, all of us in the House, and particularly those of us from your native state, have been made proud. You have done your neighbors and all of your countrymen proud today, and we congratulate you.
Now, Mr. Speaker, the gentlewoman from California, Ms. Burke.
Mr. Speaker, I join my colleague in paying tribute to this great American, the senior senator from Minnesota, and his gracious Lady Muriel. Senator Humphrey, you have won a place in our hearts, the hearts of millions of Americans, but particularly the hearts of minority Americans. You fought so hard to make this country recognize that every citizen must enjoy the rights of our country. Our Speaker and our Majority Leader have referred to that 1948 Democratic Convention, the pleas that were made by Senator Humphrey. And I want to say that there are many who remember and enjoy the results of those pleas. And I'd like to share with this body the words that were said on that occasion. There are those who say to you, we are rushing into this issue of civil rights. I say we are 172 years late. There are those who say this issue of civil rights is an infringement on states' rights. The time has arrived for the Democratic Party to get out of the shadow of states' rights and walk forthrightly in the bright sunshine of human rights. Senator Humphrey, you fought and you championed again and again for human rights. In 1964, for the Civil Rights Act. In 1965, for the Voting Rights Act. And the results of that Voting Rights Act increased not only the voting rights of people all over this nation, but today there has been a threefold increase in blacks and minorities who hold elective office. You fought for Johnson's Great Society. And that society addressed the economic needs of our country. Well, today, you and my colleague from California, Congressman Augustus Hawkins, have a piece of legislation that seeks to address the whole question of unemployment of millions of Americans. And I know that you'll keep going forward in that fight. Now, my colleagues have called you a moving force, never ending in your pursuit of happiness and equality for all. Your ideals have challenged us. They've challenged us as individuals. They've challenged us as a nation. They've challenged us as members of Congress to meet each piece of legislation that comes before us with open minds, recognizing the needs of all for equal justice and fairness. So I join in paying tribute, expressing my heartfelt thanks and gratitude. And I say welcome back. We need you and we miss you.
Speaker and Hubert, another good neighbor from Minnesota, Mr. Quee.
Mr. Speaker, Senator Humphrey, Muriel, good friends. When John Blatnick left the House, that made me the dean of the Minnesota Congressional Delegation. So I speak as the dean, but also as a friend of yours. Senator Humphrey. And it's certainly a privilege for us to welcome you to this House as a man this nation respects and loves so much. We've known you a long time in Minnesota, especially those of us in the Republican Party. One of the reasons for our weakened conditions. But knowing you of all of that time, I've learned a great affection and love for you. And it came from an experience when we were together one time, when you really showed the quality of yourself, and you said, the only thing I don't like about Quee is he gets too many votes. But no matter what our politics, we Minnesotans have long admired Hubert H. Humphrey for his vision, his compassion, and his leadership. These are the qualities that have permitted him to be an unusually effective public servant. As has been mentioned before this afternoon, human rights, fair employment, ending racial discrimination, which have been the slogan for the 1960s and the 1970s, were championed by Senator Humphrey long before fact, 2 decades before. And this came to the nation's attention while he was the mayor of Minneapolis. I've noted that in dealing with you, Senator Humphrey, is that when we would talk about the matters that I have a deep concern in, we wouldn't ever get into how does Minnesota get the most amount of money. But we go immediately to the problem of helping the disadvantaged child, the needy, and how we can best help that individual. And so I know myself, a slogan that you used in the campaign when you came to the Senate, you know he cares. Most people never fully use the powers they possess to advance the good that exists in themselves and others. But Hubert Humphrey has a special capacity to bring out the good that is in us, and he has wisely used this capacity to push for programs that have nourished the hungry, improved the incomes of the poor, cared for the sick, educated the young, raised the spirits of the old, restored faith in the minorities, and proclaimed worth in the handicapped. And frankly, it would take a Humphrey-like speech to list all of the accomplishments. But let me say that Hubert Humphrey is loved by millions because he has an unbridled bundle of energy motivated by a desire to act not for himself, but for the others. And the author of Proverbs must have had the happy warrior in mind when he wrote, "He that has mercy on the poor, happy is he."
Gentleman from Arizona, a fellow sojourner on the campaign trails, Morris Udall.
Hubert, you've done a miracle today. You know, we're suspicious and jealous of those 100 of you down the other side of this building in that exclusive club called the Senate. There isn't a one of them could come in here in the afternoon, any afternoon, and fill this chamber. And that's what a great tribute to you, my friend. And I'm going to analyze you a little bit here and try to figure out why this occurred. It isn't because of that sharp mind that everybody has talked about that cuts through like a buzzsaw the tough issues of the day. And it isn't your contribution to brevity and political oratory, which has been mentioned here. I once gave him the award, the Hubert H. Humphrey Loving Cup for Verbal Continuity. And I'm not just going to praise you, I indict you, because there are millions of Americans, your fellow taxpayers, who've sat through 60-minute speeches that Muriel knew ought to be 25-minute speeches. But we've all kidded about his oratory. The plain fact is that this man is the premier political stump orator of this generation. Nobody can come near. Hubert Humphrey's speech has always made you feel good. You laughed a little bit, and you cried, and you felt good about yourself and good about your country. But that doesn't explain this outpouring here today, and I'm going to try to analyze it, and I think there are just 2 or 3 threads, if I can. One of them is this enthusiasm that's been mentioned. Hubert Humphrey believes in the politics of joy. He thinks we can do something about our problems, that you can help people. I remember he was a brash young senator charging around, debating this and introducing bills, and somebody said, "Hubert's got more solutions than there are problems." Well, that's part of it. But part of it is that he cares. I measure a politician by what he cares about. What's he willing to run risks of losing his office or losing an election? What does he care about? He cared about the old widow in the nursing home and the mother who had a son off at war and the farmer who had to close up and go back to the city because they'd gone broke on the family farm. He cared about all of these people. And that's a key part of his appeal to all of us here today. I think another thread in this remarkable career is a capacity, an almost record capacity, for love and for friendship. Not a mean bone in his body. I never heard him say a mean thing about anybody. We had a little struggle last year for the nomination in our party, and during the course of that, the man who finally won had some not very magnanimous things to say about Hubert. And instead of coming back up here to throw up roadblocks, he appoints himself the manager for the president in the Senate. He's his friend, and he's going to get his program through. He kills his enemies with love. Lincoln was once chided Hubert because he didn't destroy his enemies. Why wasn't he mean and destroy his enemies? And he said, "Do I not destroy my enemy when I make him my friend?" And that's the way that Hubert Humphrey operates. And I suppose maybe there's one other thread in this great day of macho, when grown men aren't supposed to cry or show emotion. One of the standing jokes in the Washington Press Corps was that Hubert Humphrey had shed more tears publicly, perhaps enough to cure the drought in Minnesota. But he's tough enough to be gentle. And I think he learned that from Muriel, or maybe his mother out there in the Badlands of South Dakota, where he grew up. But I remember watching on television a couple of weeks ago, he went back to his old labor friends in Minnesota, and he choked up a little bit. And when he recovered, he said something you ought to write down. He said, "A man that has no tears has no heart." Well, he's got a heart as big as the plains of South Dakota, this guy that we honored here today. So Hubert, I think of Will Rogers, who said, "I never met a man I didn't like." I've never met a man or woman didn't like Hubert Humphrey. He doesn't like this, not a bit. It would take all the paper, and he says to go on, and I will just one moment. It would take all the paper in Minnesota to list the names of his friends and admirers, and if he's got any enemies, you could list them all on the back of a calling card. And so, Hubert, the Almighty didn't make very many men like you, and we love you. We want you around. We hope you'll come back often. Thanks so much.
And finally, Mr. Speaker, a close, long-time personal friend of our honoree, the gentleman from Illinois, Paul Simon.
Mr. Speaker and my colleagues in the House, and Senator Humphrey and Muriel, first, a little historic footnote. As far as I know, in the long history of this House, from the first Speaker Muhlenberg to Speaker O'Neill, this is the first time the House has stood in recess and gathered on an occasion like this to honor a United States Senator. And I thought you'd be interested in that minor footnote. Everything has been said already, but let me add one little story. We all have Humphrey stories. I remember in the 1968 campaign, when he came through Illinois, I'd have a chance to hop on that plane and go around with him a little bit. And we got behind schedule. Somehow the candidate for president always spoke longer than the schedule called for. And we were in Peoria or Rockford. I remember in Rockford, the PA system went out. It didn't bother you for one moment. You just went right on talking. But we were this delayed presidential trip. And, you know, once he got through speaking, everybody's trying to rush him on so we could try and catch up. And all of a sudden, behind a barrier, Hubert Humphrey spotted this little 11-year-old or 12-year-old retarded girl. And he stopped and went over and shook hands and chatted with her. And it really symbolized Hubert Humphrey for me, reaching out for the disadvantaged, whoever they are, wherever they are. The retarded, the hungry, the unemployed, those oppressed for whatever reason. That's Hubert Humphrey. He's not only your friend and my friend, he's the friend of all humanity. Well now, Mr. Speaker, knowing full well the dangers of what I'm about to do, I yield as much time as he wishes to consume to the senior senator from Minnesota.
White House, when the President was kind enough to have us in for supper, leadership of the House, the Senate, Democratic leadership, he said, we'd like to adjourn these meetings at 9 o'clock. He went around the table and asked each participant, each senator, if he had any comments, any advice, any counsel. I was the last to be asked. And it was 9:03. I'm everlastingly grateful to your distinguished speaker, my beloved friend, Tip O'Neill, who said, Mr. President, Hubert can't say hello in 3 minutes. And I couldn't help but remember that I'd missed at least 5 of these leadership meetings. I felt I was entitled to compensatory time. And I proceeded to take it. Mr. Speaker, the members of this great body representing the people of the United States. This is an honor that I never believed could happen. I never expected it to happen. It was far beyond any dream I ever had, and I'm a great dreamer. But let me tell you something, it is an experience that I shall never forget, and I shall be eternally grateful to each and every one of you for the warmth of your reception. In the manner in which you have brought Mrs. Humphrey and myself into your fellowship. Thank you very, very much. Now, I've gone through quite a few of these sentimental occasions. And I heard about the tears that I'm capable of shedding, and that's true on occasion. And let me tell you, it's not an easy matter to listen to what I have heard. And of course, I loved every word of it. I appreciate the fact that you have abandoned objectivity and have decided to be just friendly and forgiving. It is one of the great virtues to forgive. And I thank you for starting by forgiving Hubert Humphrey for his many transgressions. But what's bothered me, and I say this to my fellow Democrats, is the incredible humor of the Republicans in this chamber. You know, I'm glad I didn't know about this earlier. I wouldn't have been able to go around and say, you know, they're stuffy and all that sort of thing. I hope that you'll revert to the stereotype that we Democrats have for you, because if Bob Michael and Bill Frenzel and Al Quie and others like them get out on the stump and exhibit the kind of humor and the light touch that they have here, It'll mean woe under we Democrats. Unless we can get Mo Udall to get into every district. I intend to come back to Mo in just a few minutes. But I first want very much to say thank you to the majority leader, who's been a longtime friend of mine, Jim Wright, a great friend. And my thanks to Don Frazier and to Paul Simon, of course. Don has told you the truth. He started his politics with me when I was a very young man as mayor, and he was very much younger. As I recollect, I think he was at meetings with a mimeograph machine, turning out resolutions that we were trying to concoct to save the world. Now, I want to also say that Paul Simon has been a special friend, one that just is so loyal, so willing to be helpful, that you really have to kind of weigh his words when take them with a grain of salt when he talks about me. Paul, I'm grateful to you, and it's meant a lot to me that you should kind of tie up the ceremonies here before I got to speak. And Yvonne Burke, lovely. Yvonne and I have campaigned together in California. Great fun too, honey. I'll tell you, it's great fun. I like Gus Hawkins and I like you better. I miss John Rhodes here today. John's a good personal friend of mine, as is John Anderson, Paul Finley down there, all of us liberals, all working together. I thought it was very impressive today to be called the genuine liberal and have my Republican friends just applaud. I guess the word has lost its meaning, there's no doubt about that. Now, Mo Udall, you're something. You really just scared the living daylights out of all your contenders in 1976. That's what I kept doing. I kept scaring them, but never getting quite enough, you know, so they'd be really afraid. You got up here with the kind of humor that is impossible to follow. But I'm going to make a correction or so. You see, because as much as I admire Mo, his vision has somehow or another been limited. He has said that I had more solutions than there were problems. That's not true. I just foresaw the many problems that were coming and was advancing the solutions. Now, all of you know that I thought that if you're going to be in politics, you ought to enjoy it. Because there's plenty of heartache, as you know, many sacrifices, and of course there are many rewards, and we know that. But I have always enjoyed public life, and I like to speak. And there's any doubt about what you've said about the fact that on occasion, like most of the time, I speak a little longer than certain parts of the anatomy can take. But I have to tell you, one of the reasons I never ran for the House, I had planned on running for the House, as a matter of fact. But one of the reasons I didn't is that I found that they had either a 2-minute or a 5-minute rule. And I said, this will drive me into utter frustration. I'll be a nervous wreck. So I gave it a run at the Senate. And I want to tell you, we have wonderful rules over there. Of course, I've never thought my speeches were too long. I've enjoyed them. And I remember one time Muriel said to me after a meeting, and this regrettably is true, she says, Dad, I said, what'd you think of the talk? And she said, it was good. But she said, you know, your speeches don't have to be eternal to be immortal. I don't know if that was supposed to be said in as a matter of admonition or just one of humor, but it's gotten around, so I thought I'd repeat it once more. Now, dear friends, in a more serious vein, I said it was a very high honor. I believe it's an incredibly unusual experience for a member of the Senate of the United States. come into this body and to have this opportunity. I think I should say, in some jest, but also in some truth, because before the reality is the dream. I'd always dreamed of flying on Air Force One. As I've said to the Senate the other day, I finally got a chance. Just once, that you know, but the president stopped out in Minnesota, picked me up. I spent 20 years trying to get in command of that plane. Finally, I got my ride. And I know where I'm standing. I'm standing where the President of the United States gives his State of the Union address. My goodness, how I long for that opportunity. Well, you see, the age of miracles is not over. Things can happen, and I am singularly honored that this is happening to me. It's very comfortable here. I would have worked a little harder had I known this. You know, we had a lot of criticism of Congress. I suppose a good deal of it we deserved. Congress is a very human institution, and I mean not only the House of Representatives, but that other body that sometimes does not want to think of itself as being human. But we are humans, we are mortals, we are what we are from our background, our experience, our families, our lifestyle. We are America. We're no elite. We haven't been appointed by some great authority that can pick out only the wise and the prudent and the good. We come from the people. And I think in a very real sense, we represent the people. But this bothers some people. We have people today that feel that, well, Congress dilly-dallies around and doesn't get anything done. They argue and they debate and they carry on and they offer all kinds of foolish amendments and bills. Well, I've been around down here long enough to know that that doesn't just happen. That's because of the constituencies that we represent and the views that we come from our own experiences, our own life, our own value systems. And I think that's the way it ought to be. I've always believed that when it came right down to it, that there was no form of government that was better in the long run for the people than majority rule with respect for and protection for minority rights. That's what we mean by government of the people, by the people and for the people. I can only paraphrase what the great Winston Churchill said, but he said something like this. He says, you know, democracy is the worst possible form of government, except all others that have been tried from time to time. If you just ponder that, what he's really saying is that we're a human institution. We're fragile. We're tempted. We're weak. We're also strong. We're informed. At times we're not informed and literally ignorant of some of the problems and needs. But this is it. No other form of government so clearly represents the needs of people. And it is amazing that in this country, with a heterogeneous population, not a homogeneous population, in this country that grew in a little over a century to be a major power, and in two centuries to be the superpower, in this country in which they are the sons and grandsons and daughters and granddaughters of immigrants, over 100 different races, creeds, and nationalities, that we've been able to hold together representative government, that we haven't torn apart, yes, once, over the issue of slavery, the bloodiest war in our history, And now don't we remember how long it took to bind up those wounds? Even to this day, we're working at it. But we have survived. And not only have we survived, we have prospered. We're prone to be very self-critical. That's good. Only the strong dare admit their weakness. It is the weak who are the braggadocios, the bullies. And I always hope that America will be willing to engage in self-analysis. We need opposition. I've said that, but I don't want too much personally, but I mean, you need it. We do need it. We need the advocates. And each of us in our own way is an advocate. I guess I have mellowed enough to know that I have no monopoly on either virtue or wisdom. None of us have. And what we should strive for above all, at a time when democracy is an endangered species, is to make this great experiment of American democracy work, to bind up our wounds, to be able to bring people into closer communication, not to expect them to agree with each and everything that we want, to respect their cultures, their races, their religions, their political views. But at the same time, to constantly preach and live by the doctrine that once that we've had our say, that once that we've been able to make our position clear, that what the majority, what the people vote as a majority in any given election, that shall be the ruling power until the next election. I think you know this better than I do, because you come up every 2 years. It's not an easy task. But my plea here is today, as members of the House, and you're so close to your people. It's so easy when you go home to say, well, you know, laugh about Congress. It's all right for us to joke a little bit about our institutions. But I'm here to tell this body that there is no parliament in the world, none, that is as open, that is as free, that is as dynamic, that is as truly representative of all the many peoples as the House of Representatives of the United States of America and the Senate of the United States. We are the supreme example of government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And that's our great strength. That's the problem, you see. I guess I like to lecture. It's one of the reasons we're going to have what we hope will be a great educational institute at the University of Minnesota, Hubert Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. It will represent the many different disciplines of government, community action, economics, social science. We need to know more about our country. We need to know more about our world. We are all children of one God. We live on a very small planet. But insofar as we know, it's the only planet that sustains life. Therefore, apparently, we have been selected for unusual and special purpose. I believe that purpose is to try to demonstrate that the power of understanding and reason and love can prevail. It isn't easy, and there are many times that you want to give up. But you have to have spirit. You have to have faith. There are times when you can lose faith in the institutions of our government, as we almost did. But, dear friends, it was restored. I want to say from this platform what I said privately to Gerald Ford. His name will go down in history because he restored to American government integrity and decency. I'm not worried about the fact that I didn't agree with his economics, but he gave us something. A man from your midst, how important that is. we may very well one of these days almost stand alone, because as the tide of events whirls over us, it appears that it's harder and more difficult year by year for freedom to survive. So therefore, we must be extra strong, not in our military might, because that we'll take care of. You do that, and I do that. But individually, we must be strong. We must be strong in our commitment to human freedom and justice. We must be strong in our commitment to opportunity and equal opportunity. We must be strong in our commitment in the care of the needy and the sick and the handicapped, and in the maintenance of an economic system and a political system that will make it possible for us to care for those who are less fortunate. It all goes together. Well, Mr. Speaker, I took one more minute than I took at the White House, but I've always thought Congress, well, not always, but more recently, I thought Congress deserved more attention. And I want to thank you very much from the bottom of my heart for this marvelous occasion.
The members may continue to greet the Senator. The House will be in recess till the hour of 3:45. The House will be in recess till the hour of 3:45.